From GEICO Subconscious News, I'm Tammy Racing Thoughts, broadcasting from your brain. Tonight's top worry. If something happens to your apartment and you need to, like, stay in a hotel and pay for it, that would be crazy, right? Art Palpitations has more.
That would be crazy, Tammy, but you got surprisingly affordable renter's insurance through GEICO, so it could be covered, giving you peace of mind.
Aww, I love a story that ends well.
Next up, love stories. Are they all they're cracked up to be?
It feels good to worry less. It feels good to GEICO.
Alive and Kicking
with Claire McKenna
on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show aliveandkicking at newstalk.com, or you will find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, the changing face of poverty and the importance of giving back. The power your kitchen holds and how to set yourself up for success. And I'll also be joined by Paul Reynolds, a leadership coach using breathwork to help people think clearly under pressure. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, man, the joy of a slowed down week. I am beginning to share my son's point of view that perhaps we should just have no school and just wait to see how AI pans out. I mean, I imagine there could be some sort of anarchy down the road. And I know once I got into the whole no school thing, I'd be craving routine and them going back. But suffice to say, I've had a lovely couple of weeks for the Easter school holidays. A slower pace, more family time, and I was definitely up for the sunny days and the colourful decorations through the house. And I went this week to have my carotenoid levels tested. I've had Professor John Nolan on the show many times talking about his research around macular and brain degeneration. And he found that people with that loss of sight and cognitive function also had low levels of carotenoids in their brain. Carotenoids are found in colourful foods, oily fish. The yellow is very important that you find in corn or egg yolks, and the more the merrier in your diet, basically. And there's a test you can take now in a pharmacy. You just put your finger into what is called the spectrometer, and it reads the levels you have via your skin. I had it done last year. I know I spoke about it on the show, and I scored well, so I was invited to return this year to see where I was at. And I'm happy to report, because with any test, you arrive in trepidation, particularly when I work in this industry. You want to make sure that you are, not that I ever preach, but practicing what you preach and that the results are showing up. I'm happy to report that I still scored above average. Happy because I honestly don't eat in a very regimented way. I don't stress about food. I don't have any rules, but I do try to eat a varied diet. I focus on fresh as much as possible. I cook at home as much as I can, and I add as much colour to my plate or my bowl. But it's honestly not a stress. I would have to say dieting was 100% harder. This feels easy and I feel good doing it. I'd always do things like order a side of veg when I'm out and about alongside chips. You know, there's no angel work involved here. I'd add a few berries to my porridge in the morning, and I really do focus on that way, adding in rather than taking it away. So it really feels good not just to ace a test and be patted on the back, because that wasn't really what it was about, but to just see those efforts, which don't even feel like an effort, rewarded via a health result. I want to live healthy and do whatever I can to really stave off the dementia that my dad and my grandfather had. And this is certainly on the right track. And I say this not to gloat at all. I know we're all doing the best we can with what we've got and what we know. But this, I feel, should be an empowering message that we do have some level of control on our health outcomes, and it can feel good doing it. We'll possibly get into this in a little while with performance nutritionist Gemma McGuinness and the power our kitchen can hold. And I got so many messages from you all about my interview with Tom Keogh of Keogh's Farm. And it is so important, as we discussed in the interview, to our long-term health that we have systems in place that support quality Irish produce at a price we can afford in our supermarkets and in our local stores. It should be protected. It should be supported by government policy and by education. But we can also be part of that change too, by asking for it. I know it's hard. I'm the exact same, usually rushing through the supermarket, grabbing what I can, rushing home then to pick up a kid or another work project, doing my best like the rest of you. But it is important that we are conscious about the decisions that we make. You can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, speaking of food and food choices, Gemma McGuinness is a footballer with Bournemouth and a performance nutritionist. She held a workshop recently on how to create a performance kitchen, and she joins me on the line now. Gemma, you're very welcome.
Claire, thanks very much for having me on again.
Because you train and play with a professional club, you know how environment can shape success, but you feel that people can transfer this to whatever their own personal setup is.
Absolutely. And that's definitely one of the ideas that has come from this performance kitchen, is that if we step away from our sporting environment where we're very focused on results and doing the best that we can when we're in that context, if we can step away and still have a very similar mindset that we can support our environment, whether we're getting into the car, we're going back into the kitchen, and we're still able to think of the things that are going to help us get the best out of whether it's the training that we're doing or our sport, to make sure that we are recovering well, we're performing well, and we're still helping ourselves out in whatever that we're doing outside that environment.
Do you think people underestimate the power the kitchen can hold when it comes to making healthy choices and supporting themselves and their well-being as best they can?
It's definitely possible. The performance kitchen actually came from, we'd started to notice a number of patterns come from our client data. So we'd built out, this is about 5 years ago now, we'd built a nutrition knowledge assessment. So it was a knowledge and behavior assessment. And we started to notice that knowledge was actually quite high when it came to food education. It was quite low in sports nutrition, but people knew where to get foods, what kind of sources that they came from. But we started to find that cooking skills, planning, behaviours, attitudes, and relationship with food were the areas that people needed the most support with to allow them to be consistent. So it's trying to get into this idea that if we step into the kitchen, there's so much that we could do with our environment that would help us to find it more enjoyable, to make it more accessible, if we have the right tools, if we have the right mindset, and if we build the performance kind of system within our own home, it will allow us to make those better decisions. So it's definitely a huge opportunity.
Are you talking about people who might be in a running club, going to the gym, or even just performance in all areas of life, that if you're feeling at your best and fueling yourself correctly, you can show up as a parent in your job, in your relationship, in your social life, because you have the energy you need?
Without a doubt, that's where all of this comes in. I suppose I speak in the sports context, just that's what I'm living that way. And the majority of my clients are in sport. But what I'm also seeing now is that more and more people are, they're training, they have a training schedule like an athlete, like they're getting into running, but they're doing a lot of running. They're doing huge miles across the week, but then their lifestyle isn't supporting the amount of training that they're doing. And that's where you run into injuries. And, you know, if you're not fueling, you're not recovering, it's so much easier to maybe speak to an athlete that recognizes they might have the space and the time to support their training schedule. But if you've just taken up a huge amount of training, you do need to kind of assess, is there space for the recovery so that you avoid these potential injuries further down the line? And that comes from the same type of mindset, the decisions that you make outside, so that you still have, you know, stress managed, you've got enough time for sleep. Otherwise, you can't keep that intensity up. It's all stress is stress.
Yeah, which is why it's so important to let go of the dieting mentality, because when you're in the mindset of eat less and then burn it off with the exercise, that's just not enough for your body. I love at the gym I go to at the end of any class, the instructor, and she's actually the owner of the gym, will say, "Now make sure today, lots of water, lots of food." And I just think it's such a simple sentence, but it's so powerful, because, you know, you have put your body under strain. What are some of the foods then, the staples people should have in their kitchen and in their cupboards that they can lean on? Because I would assume, even though you're talking about Tupperware and setting up in advance, you don't think people should be, you know, living out of Tupperware or, you know, constantly meal prepping and living only on brown rice, chicken breasts and broccoli. That seems to be the staple.
The themes. No, definitely not. Going back to trying to keep it exciting and fun, and just knowing how you can adjust meals and ingredients to make them a lot more palatable and enjoyable is a huge part of it. So after you've got the tools, you're set up and you actually can prepare the meals, is the system that you have around you. So that is getting the food shop done. Some of the foods and ingredients that can support is going to be broken down into getting your protein sources, your carbohydrates, and making sure that you've got, you know, plenty of colour in there as well to build out those meals. We would kind of try and map it to a training week. And one of the frameworks that we use is play, pause, perform. So it just helps people to recognize play is about, you know, going to the gym, moderate training sessions. Pause are your recovery days, the days that you're trying to recover from those intense sessions. You're less active, but you're maybe trying, you're going out for the walk. And then perform. They're the days where high intensity, your heart rate's elevated, you're working hard. You're going to need more carbohydrates on those days to support that type of training. So that's, you know, that's where you might start to introduce maybe your breads, your cereals, your cereal bar right before a training session, bananas, more dried fruit, things that are easy for your body to use that energy. And those pause days, the recovery, that's where you can start to look at, now I have an opportunity to increase fiber intake, introduce omega-3 fatty acids, your eggs, your avocado, nuts, seeds, peanut butter, oils, are going to be much more supportive in those kind of lower intensity days, or the days we're just maybe doing moderate exercise.
Yeah, and the more you have in your cupboards, in your freezer and in your fridge, the easier it is to just reach.
Absolutely.
And make that happen. Well, this was an online workshop that you did, and I know you plan to do more. If people want to see what's coming up, you can go to verusperformance.com. That's V-E or U-S, verusperformance.com, where yourself and Daniel Davey will be setting out lots more like this. I'm sure, Gemma, people are like, well, we just need Gemma in our kitchen telling us what to do. But no, we can be empowered to do this for ourselves, can't we?
Absolutely. That's what it's all about. We'll help you out at the start, but it's up to you then.
Maybe one of these days we'll get you into the kitchen. Gemma McGuinness, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks very much, Claire.
Alive and kicking on News Talk. Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, Paul Reynolds is a leadership coach who uses the breath to help people think clearly under pressure. Before coaching, he spent a decade in business strategy, helping build a leading renewable energy consultancy. But now he's moved to the breath, and his first book, Breathe Free, was published last year. Paul, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Claire. Delighted to be here.
And it's lovely how your two worlds have collided. And obviously, the work you do with breath work can apply to anybody. You don't have to be, you know, a high powered CEO or in a leadership role. I mean, we're all leading something, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. I really see breath work as a really important tool for life. And that could be for business leaders, but also in terms of personal leadership. And I see the breath as a really important tool for helping people to think clearly under pressure.
What led you to breath work personally?
Yeah, so I've been, on a self-development journey for over a decade. I've done plenty of weird and wild things and found coaching about 7 years ago, I guess, and then breath work about 5 years ago. And for me, breath work is an incredibly powerful tool for my own journey, I guess, helped me move from more of a kind of fear-based living to one of freedom and connection and love, I guess, being using that word. Coming back to that tool for life, I guess it ultimately helps me. I guess there's always a choice as to how we respond to situations. And in many ways, that's the core of self-development or leadership development, is around, okay, we're faced with a challenge. How do we respond to that challenge? And we can either do that by reacting, which is often a default response, automatic, maybe based on survival strategies, or we can create, consciously choosing a response. And that choice, that where we go, whether we respond to that challenge through reaction or through choice, makes a massive difference to success in life. And the breath, again, is that bridge from the react to the create.
And how does breath work feature in your everyday?
Very heavily. So I guess in terms of sessions, I work one-to-one coaching founders and leaders. And so I run breathwork sessions with them. That looks like a two-hour session. You have kind of 30 to 40 minutes of coaching at the start. You then go into the breath work, which is an hour long, and then you come back around and talk through. And it's then a half an hour kind of check in and see where they are, and then leading to actions and next steps. So that's, I guess, my work in terms of my own personal practice. So, yeah, I guess I like the kind of cadence. I would do a ground exercise once a day, be that meditation, be that breath work. And I tend to play around with different types of breath work. And then in terms of the more transformational stuff, I would do a self session once a week, or probably an hour of that deeper breathing, conscious connected breath. And then I do a facilitated session once a month. I also go on 6-day retreats. I'm just back from 6 days in the Netherlands.
Yeah, and I'm trained in breathwork myself. And Nilo Muruku, who was our trainer at the Blissful Breathwork Academy, he was on a trip in America and he couldn't find a breathwork class. Yeah. So when he travels, he will try and find one. He's open to all different types, all different teachers, wants to connect and learn all the time. And he couldn't find one, and he thought that was really pretty mind blowing. So you feel Ireland is in a good spot?
Yeah, and I did the same. So I was in Edinburgh recently and was looking around for a session and struggled to find one. I think with breath work, it is sometimes a little difficult to find out exactly what's going on and where the classes are. There isn't necessarily, well, I was kicking around a kind of centralized community website, which would give an idea about where all the different breathwork practitioners are. And I think there's about 55 breathwork practitioners in Ireland, and they're distributed across the country. So yeah, and I guess in terms of Ireland, that's a pretty good community. We certainly see it growing. There's not just me, but there's a bunch of other people, including Nadia of the Breathing Room, who I did a lot of training with in Ireland, both in Dublin, but also dotted around the country as well.
I think that's really good to hear. I really like that. I was very interested in what you said about your coaching sessions, you know, that they are 2 hours long and that there's an hour of breath work in the middle of that. So what journey have you seen people go on? You know, they come on, obviously people want to make the best of a coaching session. So I'm sure they come with questions and ideas and how it's going to go, and how different are they after the breathwork session?
Yeah, beautiful. So I tend to work on a kind of 6-month program. So at the start of that program, we have a conversation, and I use a framework called kind of default future and created future. So a default future is like, if nothing changes over the next 6 months, where are you going to be physically, mentally, emotionally, at work, your relationships, how are you feeling? And we have a conversation around that. And generally that's, well, I'm flat, I'm not having a great time, my relationships are poor, my business is struggling. And then we work out what a created future would look like. So if everything goes well, what does a great future look like for you? In terms of, well, I'm feeling lighter, freer, more successful, happier, my relationship with my kids are stronger. And then the coaching combined with breathwork sessions happen every 2 to 3 weeks to support people to move from that default future to that created future. And the combination of the coaching, so obviously coaching is all about working out what it is that people really want and what's stopping them from getting that, so limiting beliefs and so on. We have that conversation, and that often tees up insights or little queries or things which kind of makes people curious, and then you take it into the breath, and they're almost coached by me, and then they're coached by the breath, because the breath gives them insights and connections and clarity in ways that they wouldn't have got through talking alone. And then we obviously combine that. And so to go back to the start of the question, which was, what have we changed? Well, people have, they feel a lot better in themselves. Their relationship with themselves is a lot better. That makes them more confident. It makes them calmer. It makes them clearer about what they're going to do. And generally, live a more fulfilled, freer life.
And do you have cynics that come to you? I mean, you're working with a lot of business leaders, high-powered executives, I assume a lot of men. Do you find a difference between the genders? Are women more open to it than men? Does it vary? And how do you get them over that line?
Yeah. I mean, I wrote a book, as you mentioned, and chapter one of that is Test, Not Trust. So you listen to me talking, but ultimately I would encourage you not to trust what I'm saying, but instead to test it, to try it out for yourself. And I'm sure your experience, you appreciated the power in the breath in your own experience. And generally, I mean, there's often skepticism before people try it, but it's very rare that they have skepticism after they try it. And then it's, I guess it's a question about how far people go into it and how helpful it is. I guess I see breath as a tool for helping people live more fulfilling lives and operate more successful businesses. And so it's then, how do you integrate that breath-based interventions, for want of a better word, into their life, into their business? And that takes a bit of practice and a bit of getting used to. But yeah, if you try it, rarely are people like, that doesn't work. I don't think I've ever heard anyone say that doesn't work.
I love that. And I think we all know we need to slow down. We need to find a way to be more present, to pause. And I think for me, breath work can give you something to focus on, because it can be really hard to just sit and meditate, sit and journal, slow down and just be. Whereas to focus on your breath is bringing you into the present moment. It's bringing you into your body, as well as all the physiological benefits that come from slowing down your breathing. And it's free. And, you know, you can just do it anywhere. So, you know, they're all the benefits, because it can be so hard. Even people can struggle to listen to a guided meditation and they don't like the voice and they're not sure about the music, whereas it is your own breath. And I think that's one of the biggest positives of it all. And you can start small. I mean, you're talking about an hour session, or, you know, 6 days in the Netherlands, and people are like, whoa, he's just a different guy. But you're going to lead us in a very small breathwork session. So what are you going to do for us?
Yeah, so I'm going to go through a little exercise, which is, it's just going to be three breaths. And it's more of a, we can start with a little bit of awareness. Coming back to the art of breathwork, we'll start with the A. So a little bit of awareness about what's happening in the body. Then we'll move to the R, a very simple regulation exercise. I guess one of the most helpful rules of thumb is around the kind of thinking of the breath as the accelerator and the brake. So when we, obviously we're breathing in and out, and that's a constant flow throughout our life. But if we increase the inhale, we tend to activate the body. And yet if we slow down the exhale, that's like pressing the brake in a car, and like the brake in our body. And so it helps slow us down. It helps shift our nervous system from the sympathetic to the parasympathetic nervous system, and helps us relax and be more present. And we can do this anywhere. We can do it in the bedroom when the kids are getting at you. You can do it on the boardroom. You can do it on big presentations. As you say, the breath is always, always with us. And so this is probably the simplest tool, simplest technique I've found to help regulate in those range of a whole range of different situations.
Yeah, I often do it driving, obviously with the eyes still open.
Yeah.
But, you know, you could do it any time. You don't have to be on a cushion with the
Absolutely.
Sage burning. I mean, that's lovely if that's your thing. But, you know, you can weave it into anywhere. So I haven't done my breath work yet this morning, so I am thrilled to be led. So, Paul, lead us on. I'm sitting better in the chair. I've got my feet uncrossed and on the ground. So take it away.
Yeah, so yeah, just take a moment just to settle in the chair. If you can, close your eyes and that feels good, do so, but there's no pressure to. And then just tune into any sensations in your body. Maybe ask yourself, where is my breath in this moment? And this is all about bringing the awareness to the signals that are happening in our body every minute of every day. And then next, we can, in a moment, I'll ask you to just do three breaths. The breath is a gentle inhale, generally through the nose. And then the exhale is as slow and as long as you comfortably can do. So if you can take that first breath in through the nose and then out, as gentle and as long and as slow as you can. And again, in your own time, take a breath in through your nose, and then out through your mouth, gentle, slow, and long. And again, in your own time, you can do a third breath. And I guess now just become aware of how you're feeling in your body. Maybe there was some softening in sensations in your shoulders, relaxing in your feet, in your hands. Or maybe nothing, and that's all okay. I guess one thing I love about this is it buys me time. So if I'm in a high-pressure situation, could be wherever, in work or in life, this slow, long exhale just buys me time and helps me move from that react state to a creative choice. And when you're ready, you can bring your eyes open and come back.
Yeah, and you do feel different. And it's such a short, easy thing to do. And it's one of my favorite things now when I get asked to speak. I will always weave that in because people are like, yeah, no, we hear, you know, prioritizing our well-being, lifestyle medicine, it's all so important. But, you know, I'm busy and, you know, they kind of go back to their normal. But if you say 3 deep breaths with a focus on a long, slow exhale, do it when the kettle is boiling, do it before you throw your legs out of bed in the morning, do it before you make a big decision and just see how it shows up. People are like, well, okay, maybe I can give that a go. I have your book in my hand, Breathe Free, A Guide to Your Conscious Connected Breath. And the word I keep seeing, I can see it here on the back, and you've said it a lot, is clarity. And what does that mean? How does that show up for people? And how does breath work help with that?
Yeah, beautiful question. I guess clarity for me is knowing what to do. And in many ways, we only really need to know what the next step is. Often in life, we get, well, where am I going to be in a year's time or 2 years' time or whatever? And that's kind of a natural part of being human. But ultimately, we only ever really need to know the next step. And the breath, and certainly in the transformational sessions, it has this crazy ability to be like, you've been struggling with a problem, you don't know what to do, you have a session, it's like, bang, okay, that's what I need to know. And it all comes together. But on a more micro level, as you were talking about, the ability to shift from a reactive state to a creative state, to calm the body and then take a decision. Often in that moment of pause, it's actually stepping out of the noise, stepping out of the signals, pausing. That's when clarity emerges.
I remember hearing, I think it was on a podcast, that Barack Obama said when he would make a big decision, and obviously he was making global decisions, he would wait till he got to 51%. Like, you're never going to be 100% on anything, was his point. Mm-hmm. So he would wait until he was 51% and then he'd just go and he'd make that decision. And I really admired that in him. But you're only going to have that sense of self if you're grounded. And again, that's where breath work can come in, because he wasn't thinking, and, you know, is this the right decision? And I'm not sure about that. And what about this outcome? And what about that outcome? Because we're never going to be sure of what's going to happen next, as you said. But 51% in a grounded position is probably as good as it's going to get.
Yeah, absolutely. And the ability, I guess increasingly so, the ability to adapt to uncertainty, adapt to change. I guess humans in some ways are going to have to get better at doing so, given what's kind of coming down the track.
Well, I think I'm going to have to book in for a session with you, or at least come on the next trip to the Netherlands. But thank you so much, even for that little 2 minute reset for all of us. Where can people find you?
So I work one to one with founders and leaders, and I am developing a group program which helps leadership teams think more clearly under pressure. It's called The Human Advantage. And you can find more details at my website, www.paul-reynolds.com.
And the book, as I said, is called Breathe Free, A Guide to Your Conscious Connected Breath. Paul Reynolds, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Alive and kicking on News Talk. Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, Natasha Morgan is the co-founder of the charity Feed Our Homeless, and she joins me in studio now. Natasha, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much, Claire.
So you co-founded this charity in Finglas in Dublin 10 years ago. So what led to the setup of it in the first place?
Well, we set up in 2017 and we had nothing. So we actually weren't based in Finglas at the time. We had no premises, we had no car, we had no vans. A group of people just came together, and at that time, we thought there was a homeless crisis. You know, we had back then around 7,000 people homeless, and, you know, we seen the need. There were, you know, people sleeping rough, and there was no access to food at the time. So we set up a soup kitchen, and it evolved from there. It happened organically. One of the volunteers, she had access to a space next to her workplace, and she gave us, you know, access there. We set up a kitchen, and yeah, it's one thing led to another. Someone else donated a van to us, and it evolved over the years. The dynamics changed. You know, homelessness became much more than what you could see on the street. We had clients come to us, or service users come to us, that actually had somewhere to stay but just couldn't afford to put food on their table. We had families coming with kids with lunch boxes that they could take home and, you know, provide food or lunches for kids the next day. We had construction workers coming to us again, you know, providing lunch for them for the next day. And at that time, there was accommodation for home, like for homeless families, but there was no food provided. So at that time, they had to leave at 7 a.m. and they couldn't return until 7 p.m. So they had nowhere to prepare food. A lot of them had no family support or, you know, extended family support, friends. Sometimes they weren't even from Dublin. So we kind of filled that gap or that need at that time. But for us, there was so much more that we could do that beyond the food. So sometimes food is not the reason why people are in the situation that they're in. A lot of the time there's so much more to it. So over the years, we knew that we wanted to open up a food bank, especially for those that actually had somewhere to live, somewhere to stay, but just couldn't afford, you know, with the cost of living. So that's when we actually moved out to Finglas. We moved out in 2019, the end of 2019, just before COVID hit, and that's where kind of everything changed for us.
So is that part of empowerment almost, that people aren't just coming in and being handed a hot meal, but they can almost shop, like there's a supermarket shelf there where they can pick their own foods, bring it home and serve it at their own table, and that there's an empowerment in that? Is that why you wanted to provide that shift with the food bank?
Yes. Because like that, they had somewhere to cook. They just couldn't afford the food. So the mentality or the rationale behind it was, this is a gap that we need to fill. So we did a little bit of research, and at the time, there was a food bank closing in the Finglas area. So we found a premises and we decided to open up a food bank there. So again, the services that we provide now, it happened organically, you know, from a client or from a service user requesting something or asking for help. And we thought, okay, there's a niche here, or there's a gap, you know, from, let's say, from an advocacy point of view. So the core of what we do, food, yes. So two main services that we provide is the emergency outreach, which we still cater to homeless individuals. So it operates 7 nights a week. It's on a voluntary capacity. And our main clients are those experiencing rough sleeping. Food is provided, emergency supplies is provided, clothes, sleeping bags, tents if necessary. But the main objective is to find out, why are they on the street in the first place? Is there anything else? Nobody wants to be sleeping on the street. Nobody wants to be living. Majority don't want to be living that way, but there's always a reason. So when you get to the core and you have those conversations and relationships are built, they tell you why. A lot of them are coming from the care system. The minute they're 18 years of age, they're put into adult services. Unfortunately, with the crisis, you know, sometimes children are missed, you know, conversations are not had and they're put into inappropriate situations. So therefore, the likes of our service would find out maybe why they're not accessing emergency accommodation, and can we advocate for them with the likes of Dublin City Council or the DRHE, you know, homeless services, and see if we can get them somewhere more appropriate, age appropriate. So some of these kids are only 18, 19 years of age and they're put into accommodation, maybe sharing with somebody who's 40 years of age and maybe 20 years history of incarceration, which is not ideal. You know, so can we advocate for that person? If it's an older person on the street, again, same objective. If it's a couple, you know, can we get them a couple bed? Or so there's so much more. Food is just your conversation starter. It enables us to build relationships. It enables us to build trust with the client, and then we're able to work with them. Again, same with the food bank. Food is your emergency. You know, initially a family will come to us because food is what's needed. But over time, again, relationships are built, trust is built. And they might say to me, Natasha, I'm really struggling with X. whatever that might be. And because we have built up so, again, relationships within the community through, different services, for us, interagency work is so important. There's only so much that we can do. So, you know, I find out what's in the area, what services are in the area. So when a family mentions they're struggling with a particular issue, who do I know? Who can I link them in with? So for us, at this moment in time, because we don't have the funding, because we don't have the professionals within our own service, we outsource. So, who do we know? Through advocating, we were able to support a family for 3 years through an eviction case. We were able to link families into counselling services, into youth clubs, kids into youth clubs. We were able to get transition year students into work placements, permanent work placements, but that all came through a food parcel. So for us, relationships, it's so important, and that's really the core of what we do and why we do it. And I suppose from a personal perspective, I was once that child. I know the importance of somebody believing in you, somebody giving you an opportunity, someone just being there when you had no hope, or, again, you're on the receiving end of a food parcel, you're on the receiving end of, I suppose, a loss of hope, and by that one person or somebody just believing in you, how your life can quickly change.
And what was that turning point for you? What point in life were you at where somebody did believe in you that's led to you now running what you're doing and speaking as you are?
So many. I'm truly, truly blessed with the amount of people that I had. In some way, it's indescribable. I'm originally from the inner city and I'm adopted. So pretty much from birth, somebody gave me an opportunity, and I am where I am today because of that.
Yeah. And you speak with such a positive energy. How do you cope with the enormity of what you're dealing with? And as you said, over the almost 10 years, things have got progressively worse, from, the housing crisis to the cost of living crisis to the homelessness figures. How do you navigate through that and maintain this positive strength?
I suppose if you focus on the grand scheme of things, it can be so overwhelming. At the moment, we have over 17,000 people homeless registered. We have over 5,000 children living in emergency accommodation. But we need to bring it back to and focus to one person at a time and the ripple effect of that. So if you can focus on helping one family, on one child, on and I've seen it firsthand through the services that we provide, through the reintegration program. We work with an addiction service, and we take CE participants who are eligible for CE, and they are seconded to the service. And again, through an interagency approach, you see that person come in completely broke, and you see them then leave, whether it's back to education, whether it's employment, and you see their journey pretty much from start to finish from a recovery perspective. And again, that's one person, and you look at then what they're doing now and the impact. As I said, it's if we focus on what is really happening at the moment, It's overwhelming. And, if you were to focus on that, you probably would say, well, what's the point? I'm never going to, help 17,000 people. Again, that's registered. There's so many more. There's, you've hidden homeless. You have, that's not including rough sleepers. It's not including women's refuges. It's not including people in the prison. So there's actually so much more than what is registered. But as I said, if you just go back to one person at a time, and just you have to stay positive. There's no way. There's no other way to think, I suppose.
And I don't think people realise the changing face of what it is to be homeless. People go directly to the rough sleepers. And of course, that's part of the issue. But as you said, it's families, it's workers. I remember years ago, I did some soup runs with a charity, and there was a guy knocked on the door of the charity, and he was in full construction gear and he asked for a sleeping bag. And that just blew my mind that he had worked a day and was now just going to sleep somewhere. And, you know, he wasn't Dublin born. So where was he going to go? What was he going to do? Did he have any dinner that night? You know, that just really shocked me that people can be working, can be earning money and yet won't have anywhere to call their own. I'm following a woman on Instagram, a young single mom. She's getting a lot of traction. And because of that, people are stepping in and helping her. Counsellors and whatever are feeling the pressure. But I'm shocked at the quality of the places she's being sent. With three young children, we're talking, you know, not fit for purpose flats that are run down, cramped, cheap, nasty furniture and a front door that won't lock. I don't think people know the reality of the situation.
Yeah, it's a lot worse than what, as you say, what people realise. And it's only when you either work in this area or you volunteer or somebody highlights the circumstances that you actually, you realise how severe it is. And again, I think that people don't realise it's more than just a housing crisis. It's a psychological, it's when you look at the impact from a child's perspective, from development, anything longer, I mean, there's research out there, and anything longer in an institutionalised environment than 6 weeks, any amount of time, but 6 weeks, you know, onwards, you know, has a huge detrimental effect long term for a child, you know, straight into adulthood. So it's more than just giving somebody, you know, somewhere to bed down. There's consequences to this. And, you know, there's 2,500 children living in emergency accommodation longer than a year. You know, the impact again of those kids, you know, if you look at the ACEs study, the adverse childhood experience, you know, and it was a study done, a couple of years ago with 17,000 adults, I believe. And they focus on groups of, you know, neglect. And I know we're pushed for time here, but again, if you go back to that, any child that has an homeless accommodation and the impact, I suppose, of that, the stress from families to financial stress, you know, it causes domestic violence, it causes, you know, chronic stress, the mother checks out, so they're emotionally neglected sometimes, they're physically neglected sometimes. Just by the environment. So again, going back to what you were saying about that lady, I can't think of her name, but I follow her too. So you can imagine she's not intentionally, but she's not fully present there for those children. Of course, I mean, you see the stress, you know, she's trying to provide for them. She's trying to find them suitable accommodation, safe accommodation. But those kids are feeling that. So who knows in a couple of years time, you know, where those children are, how that affects the children long term.
And something I always say and live by, yes, we need to push the powers that be to bring in legislative and systemic change to help this, but that's not going to happen overnight. So how can we be part of the change? And that was partly why I wanted to have you on, because I wanted to give, you know, the charity a bit of focus so that people can support you and help you and your team to continue doing the amazing work you're doing, but also to give people a bit of motivation to perhaps get involved in their own communities. And I wanted to ask you about the power of giving back and the power of volunteering and what people can get from that, because it's a huge part of us feeling connected to the world around us, of having, you know, that positive energy that I spoke that you have because of what you do, having a meaning and purpose, but also finding your tribe and like-minded people and feeling that sense of connection.
From transition year students who come into us, right up, volunteering is so important. And another reason why I am where I am today is because of giving back. All my life I have done something, what charitable work, or I've helped in some way, shape or form, whether it was a business or, and it's it's all through those contacts and connections, again, that I am where I am today. So I think it's important to not only give back for because you're making a difference, but you don't realise what it does internally until you actually do something for someone else. And by doing that, you actually grow as a person, you know. And I think sometimes as well, you know, we can get so focused and so caught up in our own issues, you know, but it's only when you help somebody else or that you volunteer, you know, whether it's a children's charity or, you know, homeless or elderly, that you realise sometimes how selfish we can be. And, you know, we get so caught up in our own little world that we forget other people have it so much worse than what we do. And it brings it back to gratitude, you know, and how grateful we are. Somebody is always worse off than us, you know. But again, it's like the COVID times, you know, we say, oh, we couldn't get our nails done and we couldn't get our hair done and we couldn't. When we look at the homeless, you know, who had to stay out, you know, there was no accommodation for them. There was no food. Everything that they relied on was closed. You know, people weren't in town. You know, the likes of, you know, hand sanitize, you know, make sure your hands are always sanitized. They didn't have that. You know, they didn't have access to that. Toilets, women, you know, time of the month. Where were they supposed? There was no showers. There was no. So again, it was only by volunteering and being exposed to all those scenarios, let's say, that you actually realised how blessed you were. So I think it's important to give back. And it's an awareness as well, because sometimes what you think. I have volunteers come out all the time on the emergency outreach, and they go out, but they have a perception. We all do. We all have some sort of a judgment, even though we say, "Oh, we're not judgmental." You always have some perception in your head, and they go out and they come back, and it's completely different to what they thought it would be. You know, again, you hear sometimes is, "Oh, you know, social welfare, whoever's not, you know." People who are on social welfare, oh, you know, and then you have workers, oh, sure, they're all lazy. They're all, you know, you have a perception of people accessing social welfare. It's not always black and white. And it's only when you really come out and you volunteer, especially I can only speak from you know, for our service, let's say, from a homeless perspective. You hear the challenges firsthand. You see the trauma. You learn to separate the behaviour from the person. So I think sometimes we forget that as well. You know, all we focus on is the behaviour. We focus on, you know, antisocial behaviour, but we don't really kind of take a step back and say, again, I'm not condoning the behaviour. The behaviour is one thing, but it's really delving into why a person does what they do, you know, where are they coming from, and understanding the impact of trauma and understanding the impact of poverty and understanding the impact of, you know, already being a statistic, you know, when you're born. And that's what I was, you know, yeah. Coming from the inner city, you're already a statistic. Your life is already mapped out for you. You're nearly, you know, they're nearly, you know, mapping you out, saying your life is going to go one way, but it's yeah,
and having empathy, yes. And that's what you learn. Well, it's incredible work that you do, Natasha. Where can people find out more?
So we are on all social media. So it's Feed Our Homeless, or we are based in the Jamestown Business Park in Finglas. So you can pop into us, or you can contact us on email. But social media is probably the best.
Well, Natasha Morgan, thank you for doing what you do, and thank you for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
So that's it for Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Aoife Breen, and to Hugo De Silva Scott, who was on sound, and to Rory Galvin on podcasts. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking
with Claire McKenna.
Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.